The views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. During a virtual news conference, White House National Security spokesman John Kirby says they have received Hamas's response to the Gaza ceasefire plan.
We've been eagerly awaiting a response. But as for the reported details that may be out there, I think I'm just going to demur right now. We've only just gotten it. Our team is going through it. As I understand, the Qataris and the Egyptians are as well. And I think we just need to reserve comment until we've had a chance to fully examine it.
Hamas and the smaller Islamic Jihad militant group said on Tuesday that they were ready to deal positively to arrive at an agreement in their priorities to bring complete stop to the war. A senior Hamas official said they had submitted some remarks on the proposal to the mediators but did not elaborate. Meanwhile, U.S. officials are working to see if a United Nations-backed ceasefire proposal becomes reality. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden.
Speaking in Tel Aviv, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called a statement from Hamas supporting the ceasefire, quote, a hopeful sign, but not enough.
The word coming from Gaza and from the Hamas leadership in Gaza, that's what counts, and that's what we don't have yet.
Getting that buy-in, though, may be difficult, given what American officials say comes next for the U.S.-designated terror group. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
Eight people from Tajikistan with suspected ties to the Islamic State group have been arrested in the United States in recent days, according to multiple people familiar with the matter. The arrest took place in New York, Philadelphia, and Los Angeles, and the individuals who entered the U.S. through the southern border are being held in immigration violations, according to the people who were not authorized to discuss the ongoing investigation and spoke on condition of anonymity. This is VOA News. Eight people, again, have been arrested and taken into custody as a result. And in Ukraine,
the State Department has removed restrictions on the transfer of American weapons and training to a high-profile Ukrainian military unit with a checkered past. Officials say the Azov Brigade passed a vetting process that found it had not committed any gross human rights violations. The move will help the brigade, among Ukraine's most effective and popular, move beyond its reputation as a far-right movement, a perception its commanders have been trying to dispel as Russian propaganda. Moscow has repeatedly portrayed the Azov as a Nazi group and accused it of atrocities, but given no evidence. I'm Charles Diladesma.
Malawi's president, Lazarus Chakwera, said on Tuesday that the vice president, Saulus Chilima, and nine other people were killed when the military plane they were traveling on crashed. The aircraft carrying Chilima was seen as a potential candidate in next year's presidential election and went missing on Monday.
In the Chikangawa forest, and they have found it completely destroyed with no survivors, as all passengers on board were killed on impact.
The plane left the capital but was unable to land Monday at an airport as scheduled due to poor visibility. It was ordered to return but went off the radar and aviation authorities could not make contact with it. Nigeria's military has denied allegations of inhumane treatment toward women and girls who survive Boko Haram and are military custody. And the report by rights group Amnesty International accuses the military of various violations, including unlawful detention and neglect. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The Nigerian Defense Authorities rejected Amnesty International's reporting, saying that military personnel operate within the scope of international laws of conflict. A statement said the military has, quote, self-regulating mechanisms to address any proven case of misconduct, end quote, by its operatives. The report from Amnesty International, titled Help Us Build Our Lives, said women and girls who survived Boko Haram captivity were subjected to further suffering, including prolonged unlawful detention by the military and inadequate support by authorities for them to rebuild their lives. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And Mexican authorities are using a simple but harsh tactic to deal with migrants trying to get to the U.S. They're wearing them out until they give up. Mexico is driven by mounting pressure from the U.S. to block millions of people headed to the north. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa. From the Voice of America, I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 12th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi declares a 21-day mourning period for Vice President Chilima and 8 other officials killed in a plane crash.
The nation is in mourning, and the president himself is in deep mourning. Saul Chilima, the vice president, was a well-loved person by Malawians. He dedicated his life to serving Malawi.
The Nigerian military denies mistreating Boko Haram survivors. Activists express concern about the latest arrest in Tanzania and Uganda of opponents of East African crude oil pipeline. Ghana's opposition National Democratic Congress Party boycotts parliament to attend the alleged corruption trial of its leader.
We are saying that it is deliberate that on a day that the minority leader is supposed to perform 33 legislative constitutional functions in the well of the house as part of the opening ceremony, a certain high court says you must appear before me.
And a clean cooking initiative aims to cut indoor air pollution in Africa. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malawi's late Vice President Saul Chilima is being remembered as a well-loved person who dedicated his life to serving Malawi. Vice President Chilima and 8 other Malawian officials died on Monday when their plane crashed near Chikangawa, about 230 miles from the capital, Lilongwe. Information Minister Kunkuyu tells me that President Lazaro Chakwera has declared a 21-day mourning period beginning yesterday, Tuesday.
The bodies of all that got killed in the crash have now arrived in the capital city of Lilongwe, and they have been deposited in the mortuary. The president has since constituted a committee of cabinet ministers to take care of the funeral, because for the vice president it's going to be a state funeral, and the committee is in place. The president has also declared 21 days of mourning. And during this mourning period, the flags will be flying at half mast. So the committee is meeting tonight and will continue meeting tomorrow so that we can then produce a program and share it with the nation.
Minister, I know this is too early, but is there any information in terms of what may have led to this accident? Was it weather related?
What has been said at the moment is that the plane made several attempts to land in Mzuzu, but failed to do so because of poor visibility owing to bad weather. So at the moment, the accident is somehow being attributed to the bad weather that was there, because the weather was indeed terrible. But the Malawi Defense Force, who are the owners of the aircraft, will give us details or give us a comprehensive report on the same when they are done with their investigation.
I listened to President Chakwera, and he talked about the mood of the people and the sorrow of the people. Can you describe that for us?
The nation is in mourning, and the president himself is in deep mourning. It is a tragic accident. It is a shock to everyone in the country. Saul Chilima, the vice president, was a well-loved person by Malawians. Youthful, very hardworking, dedicated to his work, very passionate. He dedicated his life to serving Malawi. So people who know him, the name Saul Chilima had a lot of decorations to it. So people remember all that. And considering that he was a very energetic young man, very athletic, and he goes just like that, it's really shocking.
Recently, you and I, we spoke, Mr. Minister, about the relationship between the president and the vice president, and you were talking about there's been no difference in their relationship at all.
Yes, there was no difference at all. They had a very cordial relationship, and everyone knows that.
Moses Kunkuyu is Malawi's information minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. Nigeria's military has denied allegations of inhumane treatment toward women and girls who survived Boko Haram and are in military custody. A new report by rights group Amnesty International accuses the military of various violations, including unlawful detention and neglect. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The Nigerian Defense Authorities rejected Amnesty International's reporting, saying
that military personnel operate within the scope of international laws of conflict. A statement said the military has, quote, self-regulating mechanisms to address any proven case of misconduct, end quote, by its operation. The report from Amnesty International titled Help Us Build Our said women and girls who survived Boko Haram captivity were subjected to further suffering, including prolonged unlawful detention by the military and inadequate support by authorities for them to rebuild their lives. Issa Sanusi is Amnesty International's Nigeria director.
We still stand by what we have said. We believe that if somebody is saying that what you are saying is not true or something, you should provide an evidence. This research took more than a year, and it is based on interviews with over 126 people.
The Amnesty report said girls who were not detained were left to fend for themselves in camps where they sometimes reunite with former or so-called repentant Boko Haram husbands, putting them at risk of continued abuse from the men.
These girls were picked when they were children. They didn't give their consent. They were forced. And what they went through is more or less human trafficking and abduction. Therefore, it is completely based on illegitimacy, and it is unacceptable that they will be kept in government-run camps and pretend that they are married or something. Even if the girls say that they want to live with them, an investigation should be done and in a free atmosphere without any coercion.
Nigerian troops have been fighting Boko Haram insurgents in northeast Nigeria since 2009. The group's rebellion has killed more than 35,000 people and displaced millions, according to the United Nations. The Nigerian military's approach and tactics have often sparked criticism. Nigerian authorities said the military will engage with Amnesty International, but said authorities were, quote, unperturbed by such self-serving statements targeted at dampening the morale of troops, end quote. Security analyst Senator Irebu says the matter is a delicate topic and must be treated with caution.
Anything associated with Boko Haram is a sensitive matter. There are a lot of misgiving over this so-called rehabilitation or integration of Boko Haram terrorists. For the military itself, they are also in a very delicate situation. For once these victims or survivors are rescued, I think there's a detention facility where they are being vetted. Now, the challenge is, how long are they being vetted? The question, because the military in the first place are not even trained for the route they are playing.
Last year, a Reuters news agency investigation accused the military of secretly running a mass abortion program for girls and women rescued from Boko Haram. Authorities set up an investigation into the matter, but Amnesty International says the findings are shrouded in secrecy. Irebu says sometimes overzealous personnel are to blame for the misconduct.
The military as an institution might have committed to observing human rights, but there may be individual officers and soldiers that might have committed right violation in their own action. What I expected military is that, okay, we will investigate.
Amnesty says before releasing the report, it presented Nigeria's federal and state authorities as well as the UN with its findings. The military referred to Amnesty International's sources as, quote, intrinsically unreliable, end quote. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Gunmen from criminal gangs killed 26 people, including four policemen, and kidnapped dozens more in a raid on a northwestern Nigerian village, the latest in a spate of attacks. Police and local officials said. The French news agency said Katsina is one of several states in northwestern and central Nigeria that's terrorized by heavily armed gangs who carry out mass abductions for ransoms as well as burning and looting homes. The gangs, who maintain camps in a huge forest straddling Zamfara, Katsina, Kaduna, and Niger states, have also undertaken large-scale kidnappings of students from schools in recent years. Police in Katsina confirmed the attacks in a statement late on Monday. In Ghana, members of the opposition National Democratic Congress, the NDC party, are boycotting parliament to attend the trial of their leader. Casio Otto Forsen is on trial at the High Court, along with a businessman, for an alleged £2.37 million or about $2.9 million ambulance deal. NDC parliamentarian Roxanne Nelson Dafia-Mekbo says the opposition boycotted parliament on Tuesday because the court refused to postpone the trial for the minority leader to attend the parliamentary functions. He tells me the boycott will continue during the duration of the trial.
Our leader, in this case a minority leader, is standing trial for some charges brought against him by the government. He's been attending court faithfully. But suddenly, the court has decided that on a day such as today, the parliament is reopening. The reopening ceremony during which our leader will have to perform certain key constitutional functions is being yanked away and taken to court. As a group, the arrowhead is gone. Nobody can step in to perform his role. And so until he returns from court proceedings, the performance of those constitutional functions will have to be in abeyance. And we think that it's deliberate. Deliberate in the sense that from Monday to Friday, the court could have chosen any other date that is convenient for the parties. That is actually the part that where a court sets a date for a matter to be heard, and it means the inconvenience of a party, and the court is persuaded, another date is selected. In the same way, when a party proposes a date to the court, and it does not mean the convenience of the court, another date is suggested based on the conveniences of all the parties involved. But the court won't listen, even upon a letter being written from the Speaker of Parliament to indicate that to the court, it was still ignored. And so we are saying simply that no organ of state is subservient to the other.
Honorable, let me ask you, what do you say to some people who might say, well, your boycott is kind of privileged? If anyone else was being investigated or was taken to court, that person must be present in court bodily.
First of all, that reasoning or point will be wrong. We are not saying that we should not be allowed to attend to court proceedings. That's not what we are saying. We are saying that it is deliberate that on a day that the minority leader is supposed to perform 33 legislative constitutional functions in the well of the house as part of the opening ceremony, a certain high court says you must appear before me. In a matter where he is no longer speaking, he has already spoken and cross-examined on his testimony. So his appearance is only nominal for the record. So in a lot of jurisdictions where there's a consensus building and some understanding, he could have even been excused to go and perform his public duties constitutionally.
Is the boycott limited just to Tuesday, or do you expect that anytime the minority leader goes to court, you are going to boycott?
Precisely so. Anytime a someone to appear before the court, which date conflicts with the performance of his parliamentary duties and functions, we shall boycott. Because we have the view that Monday, which is the non-parliamentary sitting day, is available for the court to hear him if the court is so minded.
Some Ghanaian will say, are you trying to set the agenda of the court instead of the court setting its own agenda?
I think the case is rather that it is the court that is unnecessarily intruding and frustrating the legislature for performing its constitutional duty by its unreasonable insistence that a leader of parliament appear in court on a day that is needed on the floor, when other days such as Mondays are available for the court to have invited it.
Roxanne Nelson Dafia-Mekbo is a member of parliament from Ghana's opposition National Democratic Congress, NDC party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Accra. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I am James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 12. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Activists
have expressed concern about what they call the latest arrest and harassment of opponents of the East African Crude Oil Pipeline, also known as ECOB, in both Tanzania and Uganda. ECOB is an 895-mile-long pipeline under construction from the shores of Lake Albert in Uganda to the Tanzania port of Tanga. Its opponents argue that the pipeline violates national and international laws protecting human rights and the environment. Human rights advocate Nicholas Opio tells viewers Douglas Umpuga that the tactics being applied by both governments are not fair.
For a very long time now, we have deep concerns about the repressive tactics being applied by the Ugandan government and Tanzanian government towards environmental rights activists, people who are campaigning against the building of East African pipeline projects, have for a long time been subjected to unfair, arbitrary treatment in the hands of the state in cohort with the companies that are constructing the ECOB pipeline. And so the current wave of harassment is not surprising but deeply concerning, especially given that Uganda is now about to begin exporting oil. I think the more that grows nearer, the more repressive the state has become in suppressing voices of people who are opposed to the project. And we know that this is only going to get worse as we prepare for the final phase of the oil exploitation from Uganda.
How concerned are you about the people, the hundreds of thousands of people who are being displaced both in Uganda and Tanzania as a result of the construction of this pipeline?
The government of Uganda and its Tanzanian counterpart, together with the oil companies, have been paying lip service to fair and prompt compensation for project-affected persons. In areas where they have claimed to compensate project-affected persons, the compensations have been a pittance, been merely performative. It is a pretense of compensation. The compensation is not fair. The people are being forced. People are being harassed. In the case of Uganda, for example, the Ugandan government has adopted an approach where they value your property, and regardless of whether you agree with the violation or not, they'll deposit that money in a court of law and take over your land and ask you to go to the court to challenge that process. Even though you win that process, it will be years after the project has been established and you've lost your land. In other words, the court process and redress is only limited to quantum of how much government should pay you, not to your right over the property. And so this is the extent of the unfairness, and people haven't focused much attention on what is happening with project-affected persons who have been displaced, whose cultural heritage and cultural identity in some cases, alongside natural resources, have just been destroyed for the sake of oil.
How about environmental concerns? Are the governments, both governments, doing enough on the environment?
Admittedly, on the part of the activists, there have been some embellishment of facts, especially in terms of rivers and game parks that are being affected by the ECOB pipeline. These sort of inaccuracies undermine the credibility of the campaign. But what is certainly true is that fragile natural resources, such as wildlife, such as rivers, that are the lifeline of these communities, is going to be affected adversely by the project.
Nicholas Opio is a human rights lawyer. He was speaking from Kampala with viewers Douglas Umpuga. Two NGOs warned on Tuesday that tens of thousands of workers in the Democratic Republic of Congo mining cobalt and copper metals essential to the green energy transition are trapped in exploitative low-wage conditions. A report by UK-based corporate watchdog RAID and a Democratic Republic of Congo human rights group CAJJ said big mining companies are keeping workers in poverty through an employment model that results in serious labor rights violations. The World Bank says traditional cooking fuels and technologies are among the major sources of household air pollution in sub-Saharan Africa, with severe health consequences for the population. Now, an initiative to promote climate-friendly cooking in the region is introducing stoves that use less charcoal and firewood to improve air quality. Juma Majanga reports from Nakuru, Kenya.
At a local market in Nakuru, a town in Kenya's Rift Valley region, Josephine Abongo is busy attending to customers at her cook stove's shop. Abongo produces and sells clay-molded energy-saving stoves that she says are a great improvement to the open-fire cooking technology used in most rural homes in Kenya.
So what we are doing ni kuleta ile tradition isiachwe, but sasa it.
Abongo says that what they are doing is to bring back the traditional technology, but in an improved way, in a digital way, so that it can be used even in urban homes. That way, she says, they will save trees, the environment, and their health. She adds that they will also save economically because the economy is currently bad and people don't have money. The project is being implemented by Practical Action, a development-focused non-governmental organization. Jonathan Waita is project manager at Practical Action.
I think it's becoming a talk that we are moving the discussion towards ensuring that our local people transit from the traditional cooking solutions to the new cooking solutions that save their lives.
Health experts say cooking smoke is a major health risk, especially to rural populations in sub-Saharan Africa. Data from Kenya's Ministry of Health estimates that 21,500 premature deaths occur each year as a result of indoor air pollution triggered by cooking. David Njeru is a health scientist at Egerton University in Kenya.
The use of firewood, as we know, when it burns, that smoke is direct. It's worse than even when you smoke because there is a filter. This is the primary use of the smoke, which has a lot of effect in the lungs.
Unlike traditional stoves, the improved devices are designed so the flame is aimed directly at the cooking pot to avoid wasting heat. They also have just one opening for charcoal and firewood instead of three. And they are constructed with a thick liner made from a special type of clay for heat conservation. All these factors make the stoves up to 40% more efficient, reducing consumption of firewood and charcoal. Practical Action says around 200,000 improved cook stoves have been sold by more than 300 trained entrepreneurs like Abongo. Kagoto Danji Vocational Training Center is one institution that has adopted the cleaner cooking technology. Principal Malaki Manase says the move has cut costs for the institution.
We used to have a full ton, a lorry of firewood a term. But the way I've implemented it, I've saved almost 80% of that, which is a plus for us.
Last year's International Energy Agency annual conference in Nairobi called for an acceleration of universal access to cleaner cooking through government incentives and subsidies. Practical Action's Tim Mwangi says funding remains a major problem for African countries.
Well, we have very good policies, but in terms of funding, then it needs to match the good policies that we have in there.
Kenya aims to achieve 100% access to clean cooking by 2028 in line with UN Sustainable Development Goals. Juma Majanga, VOA News, Nakuru, Kenya.
And that's it for this Wednesday, June 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.
Around
Around the clock, the Voice of America keeps you in touch with the latest news.
Tune in at the top of every hour, every day of the week.
For the 5-Minute VOA Newscast.
We bring you reports from our correspondents and interviews with newsmakers from around the globe.
Give us 5 minutes and we'll give you the world.
VOA, your trusted source for news and information.